Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Weekly Rundown for the week of April 20th, 2026. We're covering 30 studies across arthroplasty, trauma, spine, hand, sports, pediatrics, shoulder elbow, foot ankle, and basic science. Let's start with our first study. Nepal and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Survivorship of Femoroacetabular Impingement Surgery at Mean 10-Year Follow-Up, a prospective multicenter cohort study. This prospective multicenter cohort enrolled 362 hips with a mean follow-up of 10.4, plus or minus 1.6 years, minimum 8 years. The study evaluated total hip arthroplasty-free survivorship and predictors of conversion in patients treated for FAI between 2008 and 2012 via arthroscopy or surgical dislocation. This extends prior midterm FAI survivorship data from Bozich and colleagues. One limitation. The cohort is 95.6% Caucasian, which may limit generalizability to non-white populations who may have different FAI morphology prevalence and cartilage disease burden. Bottom line, FAI surgery achieved 90.6% total hip arthroplasty-free survivorship at mean 10.4 years, with femoral head chondromalacia, obesity, BMI greater than or equal to 30, older age, and male sex as independent predictors of conversion. Moving on, Choi and colleagues published in the Journal of Orthopedic Trauma, titled Deltoid Ligament Repair Does Not Improve Radiographic or Clinical Outcomes in Weber Type C Pronation External Rotation Ankle Fractures, a randomized controlled trial. This randomized controlled trial enrolled 71 patients with 12 months of follow-up. The study asked whether deltoid ligament repair adds radiographic or clinical benefit after open reduction and internal fixation of Weber C pronation external rotation ankle fractures with confirmed deltoid injury. This extends the findings of Xu and colleagues. One limitation, 12-month follow-up cannot exclude divergence in post-traumatic osteoarthritis rates or late medial instability, which are the clinically meaningful long-term consequences of residual deltoid incompetence. Bottom line, deltoid ligament repair in Weber C fractures produced superior Taylor tilt at 3 months, gravity stress of 0.6 degrees versus 3.4 degrees, p less than 0.01, but this difference resolved by 12 months with equivalent modified Cincinnati scores and FAM scores between groups. Moving on, Lee and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Low Cognitive Function and Somatic Psychological Symptoms Are Correlated with Greater Risk of Delirium After Total Knee Arthroplasty, a prospective cohort study. This prospective cohort enrolled 574 patients aged 60 and older undergoing primary total knee arthroplasty at two tertiary centers, with follow-up during postoperative days 1 through 5 in hospital. The study evaluated whether preoperative cognitive and psychological screening tools predict postoperative delirium in this population. This extends prior work establishing cognitive impairment as a postoperative delirium risk factor in general surgical and total hip arthroplasty populations by demonstrating that subclinical cognitive decline, MMSE less than or equal to 25, below the traditional dementia threshold, and somatic psychological symptoms, not anxiety or depression scores alone, are independent predictors specifically in total knee arthroplasty. One limitation, with only 24 postoperative delirium events, the multivariable logistic regression model is underpowered and at risk of overfitting. Bottom line, in 574 total knee arthroplasty patients aged 60 and older, preoperative MMSE less than or equal to 25, odds ratio 0.771. an elevated PHQ-15 somatic symptom score, odds ratio 1.187, were independent predictors of postoperative delirium, which occurred in 4.2% of the cohort. Moving on, Hawkins and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Comparing Conservative and Surgical Treatment of Acute Non-Displaced Fractures of the Scaphoid, Based on Fracture Location, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This meta-analysis of 29 studies compared non-union rates for non-displaced scaphoid fractures stratified by fracture location, proximal pole, waist, and distal pole, and treatment modality. This extends the SWIFT trial by Diaz and colleagues from 2020, which demonstrated equivalent outcomes for surgical versus conservative treatment in 467 patients. One limitation, overlapping prediction intervals and absence of statistical significance in the primary pooled analysis mean the directional finding of fewer non-unions with surgery cannot be confirmed. Bottom line, in non-displaced scaphoid fractures, surgical treatment yields fewer non-unions overall, but for proximal pole fractures specifically, non-union rates are similarly high, regardless of treatment modality across the 29 included studies. Moving on, Hatzidakis and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Clinical Outcomes of Pyrocarbon Hemiarthroplasty, a Short-Term Multicenter Study. This IDE protocol, prospective multicenter study, evaluated pyrocarbon hemiarthroplasty in 157 patients with a mean age of 52.4 years across 18 sites, compared against a propensity score matched historical cobalt chromium hemiarthroplasty cohort of 169 patients with mean follow-up of 24.4 plus or minus 1.2 months. The study used a composite clinical success threshold of greater than or equal to 17-point constant score improvement without revision or device-related adverse event. This extends prior literature on metal hemiarthroplasty outcomes by demonstrating that a pyrocarbon-bearing surface achieves superior short-term composite clinical success rates, though durability beyond 2 years remains unproven. One limitation, the historical cobalt-chromium comparator cohort, rather than a concurrent randomized control arm, introduces temporal and institutional confounding that propensity score matching cannot fully correct. Bottom line, pyrocarbon hemiarthroplasty achieved a composite clinical success rate of 82.7% at mean 24.4 months, significantly outperforming the propensity match cobalt chromium hemiarthroplasty cohort at 66.8%, p less than 0.001. Moving on. Burns and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Single-Stage Press-Fit Femoral Osseointegrated Limb Replacement, a prospective cohort study. This prospective cohort evaluated safety, functional, and patient-reported outcomes of single-stage press-fit femoral osseointegrated limb replacement in 67 limbs across 65 transfemoral amputees from 2017 through 2023, with implant survival reported at 1, 2, and 5 years. This extends the two-stage osseointegration literature from the OPRA implant system trials by Brainmark and colleagues by demonstrating that a single-stage press-fit technique achieves comparable 5-year implant survival of 93.0% while consolidating the procedure, though with a notably high soft tissue revision burden of 20.9%. One limitation, absence of a concurrent socket prosthesis comparator group prevents determination of whether functional gains represent true superiority or reflect selection of higher functioning motivated patients. Bottom line, single-stage press-fit femoral osseointegrated limb replacement achieved 93.0% implant survival at 5 years, but carried a 40.3% revision surgery rate with significant functional improvements in 2-minute walk test, 6-minute walk test, and PROMIS scores. Moving on, Hollander and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Sustained Improvement in Pain with Talar Osteoperiostic Grafting from the Iliac Crest for Medial Osteochondral Lesions of the Talus, a concise 5-year follow-up of a previous report. This case series reports 5-year outcomes of the topic procedure, Talar Osteoperiostic Grafting from the Iliac Crest for Medial Osteochondral Lesions of the Talus, following up a prior cohort at mean 5 years. This extends work by Ricken and colleagues. One limitation. Absence of a comparator group, bone marrow stimulation scaffold or allograft, makes it impossible to attribute outcomes specifically to the topic technique versus natural history. Bottom line, topic grafting for medial osteochondral lesions of the talus maintains significant pain reduction at 5 years, with visual analog scale pain scores improving from 6.8 to 2.1, a mean improvement of 4.7 points, and 80% of patients reporting satisfaction. Moving on. Nuachuku and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled Indications for Use of Dual Mobility demonstrate significant differences in subsequent instability. This retrospective cohort stratified 488 consecutive dual mobility total hip arthroplasty procedures into primary conversion and revision cohorts to determine whether dislocation rates differ by surgical indication, with mean follow-up of 36.1 months, ranging from 0 to 148 months. This extends the work of Filippo and colleagues. One limitation, the ARMD acetabular revision for massive deficiency subgroup is underpowered, limiting the precision of the 25% dislocation estimate. Bottom line, dual mobility constructs used for revision total hip arthroplasty due to acetabular revision for massive deficiency carry a 25% subsequent dislocation rate, compared to 3.1% in primary total hip arthroplasty and 5.7 to 6.5% in other revision indications. Moving on, Oxoy and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research titled, Do Patients Who Undergo Conversion of Failed Osteoarticular Allografts to Megaprostheses Have Worse Outcomes Than Patients Treated with Primary Megaprostheses at Initial Resection? This retrospective cohort enrolled 69 patients, 23 conversion and 46 primary after 1-2 propensity score matching, with mean follow-up of 10 plus or minus 8 years post-megaprosthesis reconstruction. The study asked whether conversion megaprosthesis after failed osteoarticular allograft produces inferior implant survival and functional outcomes compared to primary megaprosthesis at initial tumor resection. This extends work on osteoarticular allograft failure management in limb salvage reconstruction. One limitation, the conversion cohort of 23 patients is underpowered for survivorship analysis, and wide 15-year confidence intervals preclude definitive equivalence conclusions on implant durability. Bottom line, conversion megaprosthesis after failed osteoarticular allograft achieves 15-year revision-free survivorship of 37% versus 49% for primary megaprosthesis, p equals 0.61, with non-inferior MSTS-93 scores of 23 versus 25 and equivalent extensor lag outcomes. Moving on, Barbier and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Epidemiology and Outcomes of Total Hip Arthroplasty in Patients Aged 30 Years or Younger, a nationwide population-based study in France from 2011 to 2022. This nationwide French database study from the PMSI database covering 2010 through 2023 compared primary total hip arthroplasty outcomes in patients aged 30 or younger against the general total hip arthroplasty population. The study enrolled 4,416 patients aged 30 or younger from a total cohort of 1,070,320 primary THAs with mean follow-up of 5.8 years, ranging from 0 to 13.8 years. This extends Swedish Hip Arthroplasty Register data on young total hip arthroplasty patients by providing granular reintervention subtype rates, aseptic loosening 4.9%, dislocation 2.7%, periprosthetic fracture 2.4%, and procedural complexity data specifically for the 30 and under cohort at a national population level. One limitation: absence of implant level data prevents determination of which surgical variables drive the excess reintervention rate. Bottom line, total hip arthroplasty in patients aged 30 or younger, 4,416 patients representing 0.4% of 1 in 1,720 primary THAs carries a reintervention rate of 8.4% versus 6.3% in the general total hip arthroplasty population over mean 5.8-year follow-up, with aseptic loosening accounting for 4.9% of reinterventions. Moving on, Sanchez and colleagues published in the Spine Journal, titled National Trends in Lumbar Facet Cyst Surgical Management, Rising Fusion Utilization Without Improved 5-Year Outcomes Over Decompression Alone. This retrospective cohort used the Pearl Diver database from 2010 through 2022 to compare trends, cost, and 5-year reoperation rates between decompression alone and decompression plus fusion for surgically managed lumbar facet cysts, enrolling 45,380 patients. This extends the SLIP trial by Gogawala from 2016, which demonstrated a 5 to 8-point Oswestry Disability Index advantage with fusion. One limitation: reoperation as the sole outcome proxy cannot capture symptom recurrence, functional decline, or patient-reported outcomes. Bottom line, despite a 6.5 percentage point rise in fusion utilization for lumbar facet cysts from 2010 to 2022, 5-year reoperation-free survival was statistically equivalent between decompression alone at 91.5% and decompression plus fusion at 90.6%. Moving on, Swartz and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled The Impact of Arthroplasty Training on Outcomes Following Hemiarthroplasty, a Propensity Score Matched Analysis. This database study used a national all-payer database to compare complications following hemiarthroplasty for femoral neck fracture between arthroplasty fellowship-trained and non-arthroplasty-trained surgeons after propensity score matching for patient comorbidities, enrolling 21,612 patients, 10,806 per matched cohort with 2 years of follow-up. This extends the volume outcome literature in hip fracture surgery. One limitation: fellowship training was ascertained via web search without accounting for surgeon case volume, years in practice, or ongoing arthroplasty practice patterns. Bottom line, hemiarthroplasty performed by non-arthroplasty trained surgeons carries significantly higher rates of periprosthetic fracture at 90 days, 1 year, and 2 years, and higher aseptic revision rates at 1 and 2 years compared to arthroplasty fellowship trained surgeons. Moving on, Eng and colleagues published in the Spine Journal, titled Inpatient National Trends and Aggregate Costs of Primary and Revision Lumbar Fusion in the United States from 2016 to 2022. Using the National Inpatient Sample ICD-10 PCS data from 2016 through 2022, this study quantified national inpatient lumbar fusion volume, approach level trends, and inflation-adjusted aggregate costs stratified by primary versus revision procedure, enrolling 1,212,720 patients, 1,029,610 primary, and 183,110 revision. This extends the SPORT trial by Weinstein from 2006 and 2007 by providing post-2015 ICD-10 era data showing volume stabilization rather than continued growth and quantifying the cost impact of approach level shifts and a 15.1% revision burden. One limitation: outpatient lumbar fusions performed in ambulatory surgery centers are excluded from the national inpatient sample, systematically undercounting total national volume. Bottom line, Primary lumbar fusion volume stabilized with a compound annual growth rate of negative 0.777% from 2016 through 2022, but aggregate costs rose with a compound annual growth rate of 1.41%. Driven by a shift toward anterolateral interbody fusion at 5.78% compound annual growth rate and $8.2 billion in revision costs, representing a 15.1% revision burden. Moving on. Poyalvash and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Revision Total Knee Arthroplasty for Aseptic Failure After Staged Exchange for Periprosthetic Joint Infection, High Rates of Reoperation and Reinfection. This retrospective cohort evaluated 5-year survivorship of revision total knee arthroplasty performed for aseptic failure in 94 patients with a prior history of successful 2-stage exchange for periprosthetic joint infection, with mean 7 years of follow-up. This extends the established understanding from revision total knee arthroplasty outcome literature by demonstrating that even after successful 2-stage eradication, subsequent aseptic revisions carry dramatically higher reinfection and reoperation rates than reported for standard aseptic revision total knee arthroplasty cohorts. One limitation: absence of a matched control group of aseptic revision total knee arthroplasties without prior periprosthetic joint infection history prevents quantification of the incremental risk attributable to the prior infection. Bottom line, revision total knee arthroplasty for aseptic failure after 2-stage exchange for periprosthetic joint infection carries a 43% reoperation rate and 20% reinfection rate at 5 years, with 9% ultimately requiring amputation. Moving on, Agostinone and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Progressive Cartilage Degeneration After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, Longitudinal Evidence from the Swedish Knee Ligament Registry. Using prospectively collected Swedish Knee Ligament Registry data, this retrospective cohort evaluated intraoperative cartilage status at both primary and revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction in 2,845 patients to quantify progression and identify risk factors, with median 2.4 years between primary and revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. This extends the Moon Knee Group cohort studies, which documented early post-traumatic osteoarthritis prevalence after anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction by providing longitudinal intraoperative cartilage grading data at a defined second time point and quantifying a time-dependent degenerative rate of 0.7% per month. One limitation: selection bias is the dominant limitation, including only patients who required revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction systematically excludes successful primary reconstructions. Bottom line, in 2,845 patients undergoing both primary and revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, cartilage lesion prevalence, size, and severity increased across all compartments over a median 2.4-year interval, with each additional month from initial injury to revision surgery associated with a 0.7% increase in odds of cartilage damage. Moving on, Lunds and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Implant Survival and Clinical Results of a Cementless Femoral Stem, Minimum 30-year follow-up of 348 primary total hip arthroplasties. This single-center retrospective cohort evaluated 33-year outcomes of a straight cementless femoral stem in 348 primary TAs with prospective follow-up, performing Kaplan-Meier survival analysis and Harris hip score assessment, with mean 33 years ranging from 30 to 37 years. This extends the 20 to 25-year cementless stem survival benchmarks established in registry-based and single-center series by demonstrating that periprosthetic fracture, not aseptic loosening, becomes the dominant failure mode in the third and fourth decades. One limitation: 67% of the original cohort died before final follow-up, leaving only 53 hips at risk at 33 years, which substantially widens confidence intervals. Bottom line: a straight cementless femoral stem achieved 91.6% survival free of aseptic loosening and 79.2% all-cause survival at 33-year mean follow-up in 348 primary TA days. Moving on, Bai and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine titled Increased Posterior Tibial Slope Correlates with Greater Odds of Reoperation and Failure After Meniscal Allograft Transplantation. This retrospective cohort examined whether posterior tibial slope measured on radiograph and MRI predicts reoperation and failure after meniscal allograft transplantation in 175 knees from 174 patients followed mean 8.3 years with standard deviation 3.8. This extends prior work linking elevated posterior tibial slope to anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction failure. One limitation: only 8 failure events limit multivariable model reliability and preclude identification of a clinically actionable posterior tibial slope threshold. Bottom line, Each 1 degree increase in radiographic posterior tibial slope raises the odds of meniscal allograft transplantation failure by 65.4%, odds ratio 1.654, and reoperation by 12.6%, odds ratio 1.126. Moving on. Decky and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Non-Articulating Spacers Increase the Risk of Patella Baja in the Treatment of Chronic Periprosthetic Joint Infections of the Knee. This retrospective cohort asked whether spacer type influences the incidence of true patella baja in two-stage revision total knee arthroplasty for chronic periprosthetic joint infection, comparing 97 non-articulating to 82 articulating spacers using modified Insall-Salvetti and Blackburn-Peel ratios, enrolling 179 total patients. This extends the established understanding that two-stage revision with static spacers restricts extensor mechanism excursion by providing the first direct quantitative comparison of spacer type on patella baja incidence using validated radiographic ratios. One limitation, the retrospective single-institution design with surgeon-directed spacer selection introduces unmeasured confounding. Bottom line, non-articulating spacers carry an 8.9-fold higher odds of true patella baja versus articulating spacers during two-stage revision for chronic knee periprosthetic joint infection, with patella baja associated with 23 degrees less knee flexion at final follow-up. Moving on, Giannakis and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled What is the Association Between Adding Genicular Nerve Block to Adductor Canal Block and Infiltration Between the Popliteal Artery and Capsule of the Knee and Perioperative Outcomes After Primary Total Knee Arthroplasty. This retrospective propensity score match study asked whether adding a genicular nerve block to adductor canal block and infiltration between the popliteal artery and capsule improved perioperative analgesia, physical therapy clearance, or 90-day opioid refills in primary total knee arthroplasty, enrolling 7,810 patients. 2,803 matched pairs inpatient and 1,102 matched pairs outpatient, drawn from 20,648 screened. This extends the growing body of evidence on multimodal regional analgesia for total knee arthroplasty by specifically quantifying the marginal analgesic contribution of genicular nerve block addition. One limitation, retrospective design precludes standardization of genicular nerve block technique, target nerves blocked, injectate volume, and anesthesiologist experience. Bottom line, adding a genicular nerve block to adductor canal block and infiltration between the popliteal artery and capsule for primary total knee arthroplasty produced no clinically meaningful improvement in pain scores, opioid consumption, time to physical therapy clearance, or 90-day opioid refill rates. Moving on. Sheth and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled The Effects of Disease-Modifying Anti-Rheumatic Drugs on Total Hip Arthroplasty Outcomes in Patients Who Have Inflammatory Arthropathies. This retrospective matched cohort study used a national claims database to compare 90-day complications and 2-year implant survivorship in inflammatory arthritis patients, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and juvenile idiopathic arthritis undergoing primary total hip arthroplasty who were and were not on DMARD therapy, enrolling 26,867 patients with 4,022 DMARD users matched 1-to-1 to controls with 2 years of follow-up. This extends the ACR-AAHKS 2017 perioperative DMARD management guidelines by providing class-specific periprosthetic joint infection incidence data that quantifies differential risk between IL-6 inhibitors and anti-TNF agents. One limitation, claims data cannot verify actual perioperative DMARD withholding or resumption timing. Bottom line? Biologic DMARD use, particularly IL-6 inhibitors at 7.9% periprosthetic joint infection and anti-TNF agents at 3.7%, was associated with significantly higher periprosthetic joint infection rates after primary total hip arthroplasty compared to conventional DMARD users at 2.1% and non-DMARD controls at 2.6%. Moving on, Girardi and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Type 1 Diabetes Mellitus Correlates with Increased Postoperative Complications and Rates of Conversion to Total Hip Arthroplasty Following Hip Arthroscopy for Femoroacetabular Impingement Syndrome. This case control study used the Pearl Diver database from 2010 through 2023 to determine whether type 1 diabetes mellitus independently predicts worse outcomes after hip arthroscopy for femoroacetabular impingement syndrome or labral tears, matching 760 type 1 diabetes mellitus patients 1-4 with 2,968 controls from 69,679 total patients with 90-day adverse events and 5-year total hip arthroplasty conversion rate. This extends prior database studies on diabetes and hip arthroscopy outcomes by specifically isolating type 1 diabetes mellitus from type 2 diabetes mellitus, demonstrating that the insulin-dependent phenotype carries substantially higher perioperative risk. One limitation? The 5-year total hip arthroplasty conversion p-value of 0.05 is marginal, and the database cannot distinguish whether conversions reflect arthroscopy failure versus natural disease progression. Bottom line, type 1 diabetes mellitus confers a 5.81-fold increased odds of any 90-day adverse event and a 9.4% versus 6.4% 5-year total hip arthroplasty conversion rate following hip arthroscopy for femoroacetabular impingement syndrome. Moving on, Spadini and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled Pre- and Postoperative Alignment of the Knee, Impacts Ankle Alignment, Analysis of 4,698 Total Knee Arthroplasties. This retrospective single-center study examined whether pre- and postoperative knee alignment, hip-knee-ankle angle, influences ankle alignment using long-leg radiographs in 4,698 mechanical alignment total knee arthroplasties. This extends the established understanding of lower limb coronal alignment interdependence described in kinematic chain literature by demonstrating that preoperative knee deformity leaves a measurable residual imprint on ankle alignment even after successful mechanical realignment of the knee. One limitation? The study lacks postoperative clinical outcome data and ankle symptom assessment. Bottom line, in 4,698 total knee arthroplasties, preoperative hip-knee-ankle angle strongly predicted postoperative ankle alignment angles, p less than 0.001, and residual ankle alignment differences persisted even when neutral postoperative hip-knee-ankle angle was achieved. Moving on. Arvold and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics titled Growth-Stimulating Minimal Acetabuloplasty Alongside Hip Open Reduction, a Simpler One-Stop Operative Treatment for Developmental Dysplasia of the Hip. This case series evaluated a novel growth-stimulating minimal acetabuloplasty performed concurrently with open reduction in 167 hips from 154 infants aged 1 to 2.5 years with developmental dysplasia of the hip. 77% International Hip Dysplasia Institute grade 4 with mean acetabular index of 41.3 degrees with range of 4 to 16 years follow-up and 21% followed to skeletal maturity. This extends the established Pavlik harness and open reduction literature for developmental dysplasia of the hip by demonstrating that a technically simplified acetabuloplasty adjunct to open reduction in older infants achieves outcomes comparable to established osteotomies. One limitation: no concurrent control group receiving a standard pelvic osteotomy makes it impossible to attribute the 98.2% Severin 1 or 2 rate to the acetabuloplasty versus open reduction alone. Bottom line, growth-stimulating minimal acetabuloplasty combined with open reduction achieved Severin 1 or 2 outcomes in 98.2% of 167 hips at up to 16 years follow-up, with only 3.6% requiring subsequent pelvic osteotomy for residual dysplasia. Moving on, Antonioli and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled A Novel Classification System to Predict Case Difficulty in Direct Anterior Approach Total Hip Arthroplasty. This retrospective cohort developed and validated the Davidovich Direct Anterior Classification System, derived from preoperative AP pelvis radiographs, to predict case complexity in direct anterior approach total hip arthroplasty, enrolling 283 patients with minimum 1-year follow-up from October 2019 to June 2025. This extends work by Meneghini from 2017 by providing a preoperative radiographic tool to stratify case difficulty within the learning curve rather than simply tracking cumulative case volume. One limitation, the classification was developed and validated within a single institution by only 2 surgeons, limiting generalizability. Bottom line, Davidovich direct anterior grade 4 cases had significantly longer operative times than grade 1 cases, p equals 0.01, with the classification effect most pronounced during the learning curve phase. Moving on, Ben and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Combined Superior Capsular Reconstruction and Lower Trapezius Transfer Using an Achilles Tendon Allograft, show better clinical outcomes and lower graft tear rates versus isolated superior capsular reconstruction for chronic posterosuperior irreparable massive rotator cuff tears with severe fatty infiltration in the infraspinatus. This retrospective cohort compared superior capsular reconstruction combined with lower trapezius transfer versus isolated superior capsular reconstruction for posterosuperior irreparable massive rotator cuff tears with Goutalier grade 3 or 4 infraspinatus fatty infiltration, enrolling 36 patients, 15 with combined reconstruction and 21 with isolated reconstruction, at minimum 24-month follow-up with mean 30.5 months for combined and 36.5 months for isolated. This extends the work establishing superior capsular reconstruction as a salvage option by Mahata and colleagues from 2013 by demonstrating that augmenting superior capsular reconstruction with lower trapezius transfer specifically addresses the external rotation deficit and graft failure problem in high-grade infraspinatus fatty infiltration. One limitation, The small, non-randomized cohort with unequal group sizes and surgeon-determined procedure allocation makes it impossible to exclude selection bias. Bottom line, combined superior capsular reconstruction plus lower trapezius transfer reduced graft tear rates to 13.3% versus 47.6% for isolated superior capsular reconstruction in irreparable massive rotator cuff tears with Gutellier grade 3 or 4 infraspinatus infiltration. Moving on. Udall and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled High Offset Stems Are Associated with an Increase in Revision Due to Femoral Loosening and All-Cause, a Registry-Based Observational Retrospective Cohort Study. This national registry study evaluated whether total femoral offset, stem plus head combined, predicts revision for aseptic femoral loosening and all-cause revision in cementless total hip arthroplasty for osteoarthritis using the five most common stem designs, enrolling 93,027 hips with 419 aseptic femoral loosening revisions and 2,592 all-cause revisions, with up to 12 years follow-up from 2012 through 2024 and 10-year Kaplan-Meier survival reported. This extends the Poprocki femoral classification framework by identifying total femoral offset greater than 48 millimeters as a discrete quantifiable risk threshold for aseptic loosening in cementless stems. One limitation. Registry data preclude determination of whether high total femoral offset was an independent biomechanical risk factor or a surrogate for underlying anatomy that independently increases loosening risk. Bottom line, total femoral offset greater than 48 millimeters is associated with an 83% increased risk of revision for aseptic femoral loosening, hazard ratio 1.83, and 20% increased all-cause revision risk in cementless total hip arthroplasty, with collared stems reducing revision risk by 50%. Moving on, Martin and colleagues published in the Spine Journal titled Complications of Spinal Fusion, comparing Medicare transforming episode accountability hospitals to control hospitals. This retrospective cohort compared 30-day readmission and complication rates across 18 team-defined spinal fusion categories between team participant and non-participant hospitals using multi-level logistic regression with hospital-level random effects, enrolling Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries undergoing spinal fusion from 2016 through 2021. This extends the SPORT trial and bundled payment literature by demonstrating that under value-based payment models, patient-level factors, not institutional participation, dominate complication variance. One limitation, team adjusters explained only 36.6% of hospital-level variance in composite complications, leaving substantial unexplained variation. Bottom line, team participant and non-participant hospitals had statistically equivalent 30-day complication rates, inpatient composite 28.2%, outpatient 10.4%, with approximately 94% of outcome variance attributable to patient level rather than institutional factors. Moving on, Fox and colleagues